probably to some degree true, but does that mean that Phoenix wants the circus any more than New Orleans does? Or do you just think that Phoenix or some other moribund franchise is so desperate to have the beautiful shot of Lonzo Ball on their team? And I mean, I don't mean to hate that much. You know, Lonzo Ball's...
It's gotten better. It's
Lonzo
gotten
Ball,
better.
Yeah, Lonzo Ball's a quality NBA player. I'm not going to hate on it that much. But it's not to the level where LeVar can go ahead and control things the way that he's trying to do it right now.
Not at all. All right, let's get into the UNLV signing day number two, as Coach Tony Sanchez is going to join us here in just a little bit.
It's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
All right, rolling into the 4 o'clock hour. Let's go! Live in Boise and in our Finley Toyota studios. Getting into the late signing day. We're going to hook up here in a second with Tony Sanchez, UNLV football coach. Following this, Adam, what do you think down the stretch here? UNLV adds nearly a half dozen more players and bolsters the back end of the defense.
I think you can't go wrong in terms of that. I mean, I think that bolstering the back end, where we know things, you know, were challenging last year, is a pretty good strategy. And I know we've got someone with us who can talk a little bit more about that right now.
Coach, what's up? How you doing?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
We're good. All right. Well, I know you had your media session in the middle of the day. We wanted to pop you on because we couldn't be out there as we're on the road here with the Running Rebels. But give us an overview of the late signings, and then we'll kind of go through player by player.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy, too. I mean, with the impact on the early signing day, it's kind of, it's said, almost anticlimactic. I mean, you know, you sign six guys at the end to kind of add to it, but these are guys that we've been recruiting, so no big mystery, no surprises, but that's a good thing on signing day. So again, like the group, like the overall group we brought in. You know, I've said this before, it's the first time we've been able to keep a couple in our back pocket, which is a nice thing going into the spring. You can kind of evaluate if you have an injury or something, or if there's an immediate need, or maybe something doesn't pan out the way you want it to. So overall, we're really excited. We think it's a good – we're excited about the talent that's coming back, the amount of veterans coming back, and then the group we're adding to it, I think gives us a real chance to be successful and win a bunch of games this fall.
All right, let's talk about some of the guys you added. This one just came down just a couple days ago. You added one grad transfer in a wide receiver from South Alabama.
Yeah, Jordan McCray. He was actually Drew Techman's teammate in high school. He's a little older than Drew, but they played together Drew's sophomore year. You know, he was intriguing to us. You know, after losing Keys, we talked about wanting to get a big guy, a big body out there that could, you know, cause some mismatches, especially on the vertical passing game. And, you know, we measured him at 6'5 and three quarters. He's a big kid. You know, he's played a lot, you know, been a real big contributor. They changed the system that he was at. It's one of the reasons why he's graduating and moving on. They've gone to a real run-heavy system. So it gives him a chance to go ahead and kind of display his skills and gives us a chance to bring in a guy that can be a big difference maker.
So what's the – you know, I know you're great with the roster, so I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I know you're pretty good on – what is the overall look now at wide receiver? What do you envision out there as, you know, your top, say, four or five guys?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously you have Presley and you have Woods coming back. You add Jordan McCray, he'll be a senior into that group. You got Tyleek Collins coming back. You got Makai Stevenson returning. Elijah Trosclair, you know, he had a good freshman year. Now it's time for him to kind of jump back up on the scene. So I think when you look overall in that group, it's a pretty good, talented group. And then you saw the tight ends, the way they came on at the end. Noah Beam's a guy that gives you a chance. You can flex him out, cause some mismatches, also bring him on the inside, and then Gio Fallow too. So I think between that entire group, it's a pretty good group of guys that can come in and make big plays for us.
And you should probably remind the audience where you guys were just a couple of years ago at wide receiver when you were thin coming in, and then you had a ton of injuries. I mean, the beefing up of the wide receiving core in a couple of years is massive.
Well, it's huge. I remember the first spring we had four receivers on scholarship, and then we signed two, and then at the end of the year two graduated, so then we had to bring in four. I mean, you know, it's one of those battles where, you know, it takes a couple of years to get it, and then, you know, when you do have a year where you have, you know, seven guys on scholarship, and then all of a sudden you get three go down, and a couple of them are, you know, a couple of the guys playing are still freshmen, puts you in a bad spot. So when you look at it, we're going to have three senior receivers. We're going to have I believe it's three junior, two sophomore, and three freshmen. So it's a good group, you know, when you look at guys that we've redshirted and guys we've brought in. So that's one of the biggest things on the roster now. There's not one area that's overloaded that you're going to see a mass exodus that's going to leave a big hole now.
Coach, you got a recruiting class with 11 high school players, 9 JC transfers, a grad transfer. How do you ride that balance between wanting to bring in guys that you're going to have in the program for 4 years to work with versus guys who get a little bit of JC background and can come in maybe potentially a little more ready?
Yeah, you know, it's a balance. One of the reasons we were able to go with some junior college more guys, 9 of them this year, was that we were able to redshirt a bunch of our freshmen last year. So when you add that to the high school class that you brought in, paper and all of our linemen, you know, redshirted a back, a couple, you know, guys on defense, you know, linebackers, Malachi Salu, a handful of guys. So it creates a little bit more numbers there. So you got to be careful. You don't want to go too heavy on the JUCO because you don't want one class to be – you don't ever want a class to start getting into your low 30s because that's a lot of guys leaving all at one time. But this is one of those years that gave us the ability to do that.
That's UNLV football coach Tony Sanchez on the horn with Cofield and Company. Second signing day is in, and a handful of new recruits are officially with the program. Offensive line is one of those positions, just like wide receiver, you know, a few years back. I mean, you guys were thin and you were small. You know, you're rolling dudes out there who were 250, 260, 270, and, you know, just not big enough to compete with a lot of the great teams around the Mountain West Conference. You've brought in an offensive lineman late here. I assume he's going to be in a position to be a redshirt, right?
He is. So him and Leaf, the young man from Hawaii, those two guys, they're for the future. We're planning on redshirting them. And then you've got the two junior college guys we brought in to kind of battle for that. We'll see how it works out, but they'll battle at that tackle spot that Nate Jacobson left out. And they may actually move over to the left-hand side. So good thing is we have 10 offensive linemen returning that have all started games. You know, we went out there the other day for our first team run. 17 O linemen, I think 15 of them are on scholarship, plus the guys we got coming in. So that whole unit looks night and day, and it's a big, strong unit. Tell you what, one of the things, too, is we were going through kind of doing our self-evaluation, and I shared with the staff that, you know, once we got healthy, you know, and obviously, you know, Max was playing better ball, Armani got back, that kind of added a little dimension. But when you looked at the way we ran the ball the last 3 weeks of the season, we outrushed our opponents like 70-some-odd yards, I think like 289 or something, I mean, something from right around there, which is a huge difference. We've never been able to be that much more physical than some pretty good teams, you know, at the end of the year. So that's exciting, especially when you got all the guys coming back.
You added another defensive lineman yesterday, a high school defensive lineman?
We did. Nake Fahina, he's at Lawndale High School. He really reminds us of Solanoa Wiley. He's, you know, 6 foot, 265 pounds, and played linebacker, played DN, played D-tackle, played a little tight end, a little running back. He's a really, really good athlete, moves well. You know, he's a guy that we think, you know, you put 20 pounds on him, and he's got a chance to be a really active defensive lineman for us in the interior.
And then who were the JUCO transfers that you got in this late period? You got a safety and a cornerback. Tell the audience about those guys, and can they compete for starting gigs?
Yeah, they can. Gamon Howard, the guy out of San Francisco City College, and he actually was recruited, you know, he had a lot of people circling the wagons around him. We just had to make sure, the reason we didn't sign him early, we wanted to make sure that he was going to have that AA degree in May, and it wasn't a risky situation. So he got everything cleared up, and we ended up bringing him in, you know, just a couple weeks ago and got him. And he had a lot of traffic, so he's a big, long kid, real physical kid, and I think he has a chance to be a big, impactful guy. And then you can't have enough long corners. So Jeremiah Houston out of Long Beach City College, again, watch it on film. He's long, but he's physical, plays the run well, got good transitional hit, plays the deep ball well. And again, you saw last year with the way we got banged up in the secondary, it really affected the season. So we need to have more depth there, and we need a little bit more length. And then there's one other junior college guy, Noah McGregor, who's a D lineman. Good thing about him, and one of the reasons we were able to, because we weren't going to bring in another JUCO lineman, except he's got 3 years to go. He was a qualifier coming on out, played 1 year, 6'4", 253, and we have him for 3 years, so that's a big deal getting him.
I'm curious about something, Coach, because you've mentioned a couple times those last three games of the year when things really started to click for your ball club. So when you go out into recruiting, I know you're always taking a long-term view. You're always thinking over a number of years. But does the result of last season, the way things ended for your team, does that change anything in the way you go about looking at your ball club and evaluating what you have going into next year?
Well, it helps us recruiting because, you know, it's one thing to go out and say, well, we were a little banged up, we had this and that. It all starts to sound like excuses. But then, you know, when you're talking to kids and you go, hey, you know what, we got healthy, you know, you show more money coming back. You know, a couple weeks earlier than that, we had all four guys in the secondary down. So those guys came back and played well, and you have two nationally televised games. You know, you have the San Diego State and Reno game, both on CBS. Those are big deals because a lot of the guys we were recruiting saw that and saw the potential and what we could do. So, and we know the staff, I mean, we were calm through the whole thing last year. You know, when things get rough, and then believe me, they got rough in the middle of the year, and you got all speculation and all this stuff, it's real easy to start kind of, you know, freaking out for less of, you know, lack of a better term, and then start kind of pointing fingers, and it is what it is. I mean, you know what, when you're that banged up and you've got some youthfulness to you, and you're trying to, again, turn this tide around, when those things happen, you just got to stay calm and stay the course, and that's what we did. We played really good football down the stretch. Even that Hawaii game we lost, you saw, you know, us have some issues playing the deep ball at the end of the game. That's really what cost us the game. Other than that, you know, we played well the entire night. So we addressed that a little bit in recruiting, and we feel that if you come in and get our head on right and obviously keep our quarterback healthy and have good O-line play and play better in the back end on defense, we have a chance to win a bunch of football games.
You had another player announce, and you announced it as well, last week that he was joining the program, and that was a returnee who, of course, went to Bishop Gorman, Biagio Ali Walsh. Do we know what his situation is in terms of is he going to have to sit out a year, play two, or could he get all three?
He could get all three. We'll see. I came home for, you know, family reasons, and so he's working on that right now at the NCAA. We'll see how that all comes out. We'd love to have him immediately eligible. If for some reason he's not, you know, you still have him for 2 years after that. So that's not a bad situation with him. But, you know, we're excited. Obviously, he's got elite speed, had one of the most dynamic high school careers in Nevada history. And, you know, got history with him, having coached him, you know, been around him for 2 years. So he comes from a great family, and obviously we all know his lineage, and he's just a great guy to add to the roster.
You had another player who got a pretty good pop last couple days on social media, and that's a former Dodgers minor leaguer, James Baldwin III. What's happening with him?
Yeah, James is an interesting guy. You know, obviously he was actually a U.S. Army All-American coming out of high school as a wide receiver. Went and played Major League Baseball for 6 years, and then you know, when that kind of came towards the end, he decided he wanted to go back, and as he told me, go back and play his first love, which was football. So he did. He played last year at a junior college, and then you know, we talked to him and told him we wanted him to walk on. He'd have to earn it, and we're excited to have him. I mean, you watch him on film. He's twitchy. He does a really good job of pass rushing, plays with his hands well. I think he just needs to kind of get his feet wet football-wise again, and obviously making that transition to that DN spot, pretty unique for a guy like that. But if he's capable of doing it and he starts to really be consistent with what he saw on film, we may have a hell of a player there.
What kind of size are we talking about? Looking back 6 years ago, I mean, obviously the kid was just coming out of high school. He was 6'3", 205. So what are we looking at now in terms of projecting the defensive end?
You know, he's about 218, 222 right there, still at that 6'3 mark, obviously. You know, he's not going to be a guy that carries a bunch of weight, but he's a guy in certain down and distance situations, gives you a flexibility to go ahead and drop him, rush him off the edge. He's got a hell of a first step, and I think that's what really makes him unique.
Last one. Actually, there's a couple last things I want to get to with Tony Sanchez, UNLV football coach, as they had the second signing day here now in 2019. Let's talk about spring practice. It's going to open up on February 26th, and right now you guys are already out there. What can you do with the guys right now?
So right now we can take them through drill work. So what we're doing is we're going on out there, and I'll tell you what, man, it's been cold the last couple of days. But you know, we went out there on Tuesday morning, and we took them through eight circuits, eight stations. You know, each station's a minute and 30, and we'll add 15 seconds on it as it goes on. And then after that, they can do some individual work. They just can't use the ball. But so we got them out there. It was 30 minutes the first day. It'll increase every day, leading all the way up into spring football. And we're doing that 2 days a week right now. So it's a good way to kind of, you know, shake off the recruit and get back out on the field with the guys, which you love to do the most, and, you know, and just get them in shape, because they've been hitting the weights and doing some running, but that circuit training really gets them going for spring ball.
If I had you update how injured players look coming back, we'd go for about 10 minutes, because there were a lot of guys who got injured last year. And putting aside Armani, who's the biggest impact guy that you're getting back? I'm guessing it might be on the defensive line, and it was an issue with a broken foot, right?
Yeah, Nick Dadashian's a special guy. I mean, he can, you know, he does what he's capable of. He could be a first-team all-conference guy. He's an elite pass rusher, unbelievable strength. And he had that kind of a crazy deal. He had that Liz Frank injury during camp, and that's a six-month injury. So that was really unfortunate to lose him. On the flip side, you know, we got him healthy. He's excited, and he's got his mind right. And, you know, he's a guy that could be a huge impact this year.
Last one. You mentioned you held back a couple of spots. Was there a position or positions that you're like, hey, you know, if there's someone out there, that's the position I'd like to add? Or, you know, is it just going to be, hey, if someone talented comes along, do you have a specific position or positions you want to add to?
Well, you know what? Not specifically, but, I mean, if you get a guy who ends up being a fifth-year senior transferred and all the stuff character-wise checks out about him and he's an elite guy, because what's going to happen is, you know, again, knock on wood, you may have an injury or two, you know, in spring ball or in camp, and you may have to want to, you know, bring a guy in. I mean, you look at a couple years ago, and what was it, a week and a half into camp, Fresno brought in McCary, and that changed their whole next 2 years. You know, I mean, that was during camp. So having those things is a good thing. But for us, we've got what we need. But if there's an elite guy out there who's available, we have the ability to go get him now.
All right, Coach. Well, congrats on the big class, signing the back end of the class, and we'll talk to you soon, and we'll see you out there for the spring.
All right. Well, go Rebs, and go running Rebs tonight.
Thanks, Coach. There you go. Tony Sanchez popping on with Adam Candy and myself. And again, I don't know, if do you fancy yourself some massive college football recruiting expert? Because I don't.
I was just going to stay silent there. No. Oh my God, no. Yeah. Do not come to me for that.
Yeah. You kind of look at who you beat out, and they beat out some quality folks. Again, I know Bischoff has been all over this, and I think it's 11 three-star recruits they've signed. I guess if you want to judge things by the rating system, that's cool. To me, the biggest thing they did was, and it's clear, there's a sense of urgency here. They need to win this coming year. They weren't happy with the defense, especially in the middle of the season, and the biggest issues on that defense, certainly on the back end, where, you know, they got off to a decent start, but then they got the crap kicked out of them, and were down to almost no one, to the point that, you know, Drew Tecmann, late in the season, had to switch positions from offense to defense. And they do need more impact defensive linemen, and they need ends, certainly, because you know, they were losing their edge rushers. So if those were the goals, the most important goals to meet, they at least have more people in the mix now, and they should be better on the D-line with the edge rush, because they got to get more pass rush and got to get more sacks, and they have got to get bigger cornerbacks. And we won't know until they're playing Division I football. Certainly cornerbacks who can locate the ball, because that seemed to be a big issue all season long. Anything over the top in almost every game was difficult for those cornerbacks to pick up on.
I think you hit the nail on the head in talking about the need to win this year, and you kind of pegged the subtext to my question to Tony about the junior college transfers, because we know that you, at least in theory, are bringing in guys who are more immediate impact guys when you go JC, and you balance that with the high school crowd, and you come into a season where it's easy to put the bowl or bust label on the year, but it probably comes in somewhere around there in terms of judging this season as a success. So right. I'm not here to tell you which guys of the three-star recruits are going to turn out, because I think by the nature of calling him a three-star recruit is you're saying This guy has talent, but has to develop. You're not saying 4- and 5-star where you know they can get by on what they are. You're saying you're leaving it to the coaching staff to bring the best out of these guys and get them to work together. And that's going to be, you know, 6 months from now, or more than, we're going to find out more about it.
On the way back, let's you open that Pandora's box. So let's talk about the schedule and expectations. I'll also give you a couple of details on two guys that UNLV missed out on, and we'll get to what's trending.
Now it's time to find out what's trending on Cofield and Company.
All right, we start out what's trending with a point that Adam Candy was just bringing up about the schedule and how to judge next year for UNLV football. We were just talking to Tony Sanchez about the back end of his 2019 class. So when you looked at the schedule, what was your first reaction?
First thing I do when I look at a schedule is say, where are the wins that I'm going to put in pen right now? And I can do three. Can you do more than three when you take a quick look at the schedule?
No, I would never do that.
You would never? You're not even going to go there?
I would never. No, with where the program has been, and I think hopes are high. I think they can have a good season next year, but there's nothing. There are very few spots where I would call them lock spots, especially if last year didn't shell shock you into at least a state of saying, hey, let's let it play out. You can't guarantee anything with UNLV football. It was a New Mexico game, because that was one of the crazier results I think I've ever witnessed.
That game was never really a game, and you don't have to tell me about lack of expectations. I'm a Northern Arizona graduate. I screamed myself silly when the Lumberjacks came up here and beat UNLV in their own stadium. So, you know, you could talk about Howard, you could talk about New Mexico, you could bring up any number of games and say nothing's guaranteed. All right, I look at Southern Utah coming in and say that is a game they should win. I look to the end of the schedule and see Hawaii and San Jose State back-to-back weeks before they go up to Reno and say those are games that if the team is playing anywhere near the level that it played at toward the end of last year, those are games you should win. Should's a dangerous
right.
word.
I think better stated is those are three games they better win.
Yeah, given where we are in 2019 with UNLV football, yeah, those are three games they'd better win.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond
cannot
that,
afford to lose those.
No, but and yep. then beyond that, you look at the way Mountain West shapes up. I'll give you the piece of good news I see. Utah State's not on that schedule. That's good. But look at how you open. I want to go from the first conference game and go 5 weeks through, because this is a brutal run. At Wyoming, and I don't care how good the Cowboys are, anytime you have to go to Laramie is a challenge. Versus Boise. Then you go non-conference across the country at Vanderbilt. Then you go at Fresno, and you finish home San Diego State. And somehow, with where the Aztecs finished the year last year, somehow that San Diego State game might be the most winnable of the five.
I agree. I mean, from September 14th on through November 2nd is rough because there's so many road spots. So, as you mentioned, at Northwestern, at Wyoming, Boise home, at Vandy, at Fresno, home San Diego State, at Colorado State. And they're going to have, you know, here's the deal. If you want to be a bowl program, you want to get to 6 wins, eight wins. And Reno got to 8 wins last year. So, at some point, you have to start winning some of these road games, which means they have to, at a minimum, Adam, split between at Wyoming, at Colorado State. I think that's fair. They have to find a way to win one of those games, and I think they have to win at least one of the three against Northwestern, Vandy, and Fresno.
That's how you count to six, because if you say...
Yep.
If
and
you
have
say,
to beat Arkansas State.
That's it. That's the key to the whole schedule right there.
Yep. That game last year, they could have won the game.
Winnable game.
I hate throwing out the excuses, but my God, Armani Rodgers got completely jacked up by the rain. He just did not adjust to it well. He also got hurt late in the game, but they could have beaten that Arkansas State team from a year ago. And it's little things. The rain and Armani not being able to grip the ball and not being able to throw it at all That was a killer. They had a punt muff, you know, deep in their own end. That was a killer. They got beat over the top at least once badly, and then they gave up a touchdown on a sweep that should not have happened. So all those little things added up to a loss. This time around, they can't lose to Arkansas State.
No, that's a game you absolutely have to have at home, and you look back at the box score from last year, and in case you forgot what it was for Armani Rogers, 5 of 21 for 23 yards and three interceptions. Now, 26 rushes for 203. That's, you know, that's one-dimensional quarterbacking. That's not even really quarterbacking. That's, you know, that's sort of a different breed. But the point of the matter is, Armani couldn't throw the ball in that game. The rain was awful, and you have to beat Arkansas State at home this year in order to have that chance, because you look at Northwestern, you don't feel great about that. You look at Vanderbilt, I don't know. I don't feel great about that game either. At Wyoming, at least you have the benefit of the fact that you've got the bye week in there, and you've got 2 weeks after you go play against a Big Ten team to hopefully get healthy. And then, but realistically, Steve, come to the end of the schedule, it's pretty likely that we might be looking at a 5-win team going up to Reno for the second time in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, it's pretty likely that you might have to beat the Wolfpack to go to a bowl on Thanksgiving weekend. And
which is not okay. You want to be in a better position than that. I think at a minimum, if you're 5-6 going to the last game, of those six losses, there can't be many like last year where you weren't in the game and you got blown off the field. And I'll go back to the Arkansas State game, and I'm sure the coaches would agree with this. I don't know if they'd agree with this. I think if they were self-evaluating, they'd agree that in the middle of several games last year, adjustments were not made, and they were really rough defensively to close the second quarter and open the third. So they've got to do a better job of that. And I also thought in that Arkansas State game that it was pretty clear that Armani Rogers couldn't throw down the field. And later in the season, Adam, you saw they actually utilized throwing more shots out of the backfield, using Tylee Collins, using even Lexington Thomas. That was one of those games, that Arkansas State game, where it was clear Armani Rogers could not throw over the middle, could not throw deep, and they needed to give him some easier confidence-boosting passes, and frankly, just some passes they can complete and move the ball. So that's one of the things they're going to have to do, is make better adjustments throughout the season. But there's more talent. You know, unless they have another rash of devastating injuries, I don't think there are going to be a ton of excuses to lean on. We just talked about the recruiting class. I think they're deeper at the defensive back. They're deeper on the defensive line. Their offensive line should be very good to great. The one question they're going to have to answer, don't just shake off the loss of Lexington Thomas. I mean, they're going to have to find someone, whether it's Charles Williams or, whether it's one of the younger guys who were, because they lost three seniors in the backfield, including Thomas. They're going to have someone step up and be a big-time weapon, or a couple guys step up to, they're not going to replace all the production of Lexington Thomas, but they're going to have to replace a good portion of it. I mean, they can't have an offensive line run blocking and then have 1,000 yards rushing on the season. Now Rogers should help that, obviously. Healthy, have a big year, but one of those running backs is gonna have to step up.
I agree, but only to a degree. I really don't think that you can realistically expect to replace what Lexington Thomas brought. I think Armani Rogers can make a difference there, and you just mentioned the guy who I think has to become more than a gimmick when it comes to that, whether you're going to run it as some option, whether you're going to run it as some end arounds or jet sweeps or whatever, and it's Tylee Collins. That kid's a game changer. He needs to have the ball in his hands more often, because he has a weapon that the Mountain West can't defend. His speed is untouchable, but you have to be able to get him the ball, and obviously we saw with Armani Rogers throughout the year last year that having to throw the ball down the field to make that happen is not the ideal way for it to happen. So I do think that you can replace part of Lexington Thomas by designing more runs for Armani Rogers, but the problem is, if nobody respects the pass, you just can't do that.
Right. Two losses on the recruiting trail to mention. One was a running back, and I think they really wanted him because he filled the need for an Evan Owens type, a bigger back. Smaller than Xavier Campbell, but again, a bigger back. And there was this kid, Riley Burt, who was leaving BYU and decided this morning to go to Utah State. So that was a loss. Believe it or not, Adam, and I don't want to put the kid on freaking blast for this, but it may have actually been grades that pushed him to Utah State instead of UNLV.
Huh.
Which is...
I was unaware of the low academic standards of Utah State.
Well, that, and also, what was going on at BYU? He's leaving BYU, and he's an academic risk?
Listen, man.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to try to get inside what's going on at BYU with a guy, I think you're going down a very dangerous road that we are not privy to, because there are so many different things that could be happening. You know, the school that has the honor code standards and whatever the academic standards are, which I would assume are fairly high at BYU.
Right.
Like, yeah, that could be a dangerous deal. But I just don't think you have to have a power back for UNLV to be successful this coming season.
The other guy that I know they wanted badly, and he was an intriguing prospect from Northern California, he's about 6'5", 230, is a kid named Dominic Mazzotti, and he played quarterback in high school. He wants to play quarterback in college, but almost no one offered him a quarterback. I think UMass offered him at quarterback, and then from there you wonder, so how do you recruit a guy like that? Because he looks to be a high-level tight end prospect at 6'5", 230. So what would you do, Adam? What would you do to recruit him? What do? Do you outright lie to him and go, yeah, you're a quarterback, and then, you know, he's there a year, and you're like, eh, no shot, bro. You got to play tight end. How do you handle that?
How do you feel about Armani Rogers? It really comes down to that for me in the long run. If you think Armani Rogers is for sure for the next 2 years your quarterback, then you cannot in any genuine way tell the kid you're going to come in and be a quarterback, because he's not.
I'm just talking about
field.
Playing the position. I'm not talking about playing the position in the next 2 years.
Okay.
It's where does your future lie? Do you tell a kid, yes, you're going to get a shot at quarterback, when you know you're fibbing, when you just, you know, 5% of you believes that he can play quarterback? And I think that was a challenge on this kid. He actually went to San Jose State. That's where he decided to go. And I don't know if San Jose State – I saw on the social media blast by San Jose State that they listed him as a tight end, but I don't know if they told him, hey, you're going to get a real fair shot to play quarterback. So,
man, oh, man, if you're choosing San Jose State as your place to say, this is where I think I can develop my talents best, I don't know about that. And frankly, the quarterback play at San Jose State last year was – under the radar solid. So,
it actually was.
Yeah,
the other love in the conference.
Yeah,
he was real good against UNLV.
Oh, he was 50 points. And I also watched, I don't know why, God, this must have been like some sort of hangover morning where I decided it was a good idea to watch San Jose State and Wyoming. But I remember very clearly watching that game, and in very tough conditions up in Wyoming, Love actually performed pretty admirably. So, I don't think you can take it for granted that by saying going and playing for the blue and gold that you're going to get on the field where you want to get on the field.
Recruiting games, they're interesting. I saw a tweet the other day I wanted to get your reaction on. We're doing What's Trending, Cofield & Company. Adam Candy is in with us. Adam Hill, as we go back-to-back in a belly-to-belly. With the Adams, we won't go belly to belly. But Adam Hill,
I'm losing that
o'clock.
One.
Yeah, you're gonna you're definitely on the wrong side of that battle. Barrett Salee, who's really good on college football, was, I think, joking the other day, but it's a good launching point for this second signing day. Barrett said, "I miss a January full of visits, flips, and commitments. Early signing period has taken a full month of college football entertainment out of the calendar." And then he asked a poll question. He said, you know, what would you do about it? Your chances were your options were eliminate early signing period, move early signing period to summer, keep it as is, or let kids sign whenever. I think this new dual signing period deal is great. Do you see a downside to it? I think it is essential for programs like UNLV and really programs around the Mountain West Conference, group of five schools. Without this, the way I viewed what was going on before they added this second signing date was complete Armageddon and embarrassing. And I thought put coaches in a position where they were just, I mean, talk about not practicing what you preach. You know, all these schools are pitching loyalty and dedication and high character, and then coaches were forced to be complete dirtbags trying to flip players. I thought it was ridiculous.
We established earlier in this show that I am not the college football recruiting expert, so I want to throw a question back to you on this and say, you said that UNLV, Group of Five, Mountain West schools benefit from it. Where do you think the greatest benefit comes from?
Because they can get a class of 12, 15 guys early. They're not out there in limbo. Because what was happening in the past is Group of Five and also the back end of the Power Five conferences, you would get 15 verbal commitments, and then the big schools basically would, you know, wage their war over the four and five stars and then start poaching from below. And for the kids, it was unfair. There's also a lot of kids at the end of the road that would be promised something or actually would commit. You'd have a verbal commit to a big school, and then, hey, you know what? Someone more inviting is now available. Sorry, kid, the scholarship's not available. So it's just brought an order to the whole thing that didn't exist before. And it shouldn't be, you know, Tony Sanchez's job to go out, work his ass off for years, you know, or months, whatever the case may be when they get on a guy, get a commitment, and then all of a sudden Oregon comes in and plucks a dude away. Colorado comes in and plucks a guy away. Baylor comes in and plucks a guy away. That's not recruiting anymore. And it had just gotten to a point where it was ugly, and it was unfair for the Group of Five schools.
Now, the word that just sort of sits funny, and I know you emphasized it, is entertainment. God, I mean, I know it's content. I know people love it. I know message boards light up over this stuff, and people are
it's such a small demo in the sports audience that goes gaga over this recruiting thing. You know, just for a little bit of entertainment, it was ridiculous. And there's, I mean, do I sound like a cheese ball? Like, let's worry about the kids too. You know, a kid should be able to just make a decision and then finish out the rest of his scholastic career, enjoy that without being freaking tortured by having football coaches call him, you know, every day for a couple of months, and then he's got to make a character decision. He's got to make a moral decision, and then the great thing on that is it's actually the sad thing is, you know, you have kids flipping, and then all of a sudden fan bases are pissed off at the kid, and it puts the kids in a weird position.
I'm going to take you back to a time when I was covering college football, when I was covering Northern Arizona, and we were up at Media Days in Park City, Utah. There are worse places to be for Media Days. And I'm sitting down at the hotel bar with the NAU football coach at the time. And he says to me as we get into the conversation, Adam, what do you think it would be if your life were in the hands of 18 and 19-year-olds? Like, how would you deal with that? How would you deal with the fact that your future, your career, depends on what an 18-year-old kid does? And in a way, that's what we're talking about here, because if you're talking about relying on the decision-making skills of a 17- or 18-year-old young man and the moral compass of someone who's making seven figures based upon what that 17-year-old decides and how easy it is to sway a 17-year-old, then I don't think that relying on everyone to, quote, make the best choice is the smart way to go.
Right. We trust everyone to behave themselves. Well, it got to a point where they couldn't be trusted. The 17 and 18-year-old, the head coach at a football program making gigantic money, the assistant coaches at a program making gigantic money. There needed to be some sort of rule brought in, and I think they did a great job. And it was uneventful, and you didn't hear about, you know, a bunch of hate on kids and, you know, decisions laid and schools trying to crap on each other. I mean, who knows? We can only imagine what is said via text or on the phone as someone is trying to turn someone from another school. And that's the beginning of a kid's college football career. Those are the lessons he learns.
I honestly don't want to think
about selfish, that. Be selfish, be nasty, you know, rip on your opponent, show no respect for him. It's just total garbage. All right, on the way back, let's get to some updates with our Eye on Sports Gaming. I want to concentrate on what happened in New Jersey because, Nevada never seems to lose Super Bowl betting, and New Jersey got its ass whooped this first time around.
Cofield & Company's Eye on Sports Gambling, presented by Swagger Men's Grooming.
I'm going to kill your bookmaker. I'm going to rip his throat out. I will step on his throat until the man chokes. Let me tell you how. Winners, 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 winners. Free, 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 free.
We have a ton of sports gambling news to get to outside the market, and Adam Candy's in with us, and he works for a great site, Legal Sports Report, LegalSportsReport.com, at LSP Report. So let's go through some recent stories, Adam, that you guys had posted. First of all, this one goes back to Super Bowl Sunday. What's your understanding? What have you heard about what happened to New Jersey sportsbooks for the Super Bowl? Here, we in Nevada, the books, we didn't win, the players, but the books won $11 million on a $146 million handle in New Jersey. The handle was, sounds like a disappointing, $35 million wagered on the Super Bowl, and they lost. The books lost $4.5 million. What happened?
Yeah. Oh, man. This dominated my day with Legal Sports Report yesterday. I wrote three different stories about what happened, mostly with New Jersey's handle. We hear a couple things. We hear significant Patriots bias with it being the East Coast. I mean, if you look at what happened at the books in Rhode Island, yeah, I mean, the books in Rhode Island got smashed because, of course, everyone from Boston came an hour over to Providence and took care of them. But yeah, in New Jersey, we heard that was a bit of a problem for the books in Jersey. And also that, you know, it's a different market overall. It really is. I mean, most of it happens on mobile. You don't have the same kind of better. So it's really interesting. The biggest thing is Patriots bias, and we're seeing a lot of regional bias stuff develop in these new markets. $35 million in terms of the handle. Yeah, I think what we've gotten accustomed to is seeing enormous numbers come out of what is a very immature market in New Jersey. We've seen handle for the last couple months over $300 million, right? I mean, 319 and 330 were the last 2 months. And I think we got accustomed to the fact that that's going to be an upward path no matter what. And I just don't think that's the case. So beyond Patriots bias, a little bit of fatigue overall. People have seen enough of the Patriots, and the Rams don't really move the needle.
Well, Adam, here's the other thing, and this is in your story. FanDuel is the book that got smashed. Now, That overall loss of $4.5 million is a little deceiving because most of it was on the FanDuel side, and I guess FanDuel could look at this as a loss leader, because they ran a promotion just to get people signed up. A $5 bet got you 53-1 odds. So for every $5 bet they gave out with the sign up offer, they lost $265 on that.
So there's a little distinction to be drawn in there. So of the $5 million for FanDuel, that's a lot of that loss comes off promo, and that's not actually factored into the overall loss for Jersey. What we heard is that FanDuel's loss, their actual loss that you heard through DGE, through the Division of Gaming Enforcement, was closer to $1 million. So you take the million that DraftKings lost, the million that FanDuel lost, and you figure, well, they're about half the market as it is. So if they lost $2 million, the overall market lost 4.5. That sounds about right. But yeah, they offered 53-1 on the money line. You could take either team for $5, 53-1 on the money line, all customer acquisition cost, right? All to bring people in the front door. Here's the other thing where it wasn't awful for FanDuel, for DraftKings, for their partners that they're hooked up with. There's some decent cross-sell that goes on with online casino there, and we know the online casino market in Jersey's pretty big. So that was a way to bring people in the door and maybe take some money out of their pockets other ways.
All right. Well, here's the other thing, because while Nevada got down, or at least Vegas books got down to somewhere between, 60 and 67% of the money and the tickets were on the Patriots.
Yeah.
When the game went off in New Jersey, you were looking at some books that still had, 88%, 85% of the money on the Patriots. A couple of things. At the front end, they opened the Patriots plus one, and, that was the same range that Vegas was in, and they got bet all the way up to 2.5, and at some spots, 3. I guess my question here is, because of regional bias, doesn't it require the New Jersey books to actually be real bookmakers? Which means you can't use the Vegas number if there's going to be regional bias. You've got to take a position or at least be a little smarter and anticipate that while Vegas is getting you know, 65% of the tickets and money on the Patriots side, you're going to be in a much worse hole. You've got to post a different number.
FanDuel's exposure on Thursday afternoon was up to 90. 90 wow. on the Patriots. Can you believe that?
That's awesome.
So, and yeah, like you said, they start at plus one. And the reason that I think that you've got a point here is because the money coming in on the Giants and the Eagles all year long was silly. Like, it just didn't make any sense. And if you look at FanDuel sent out some stats to some of us in the media. And one of the stats they sent out is that their number one futures ticket already that people are holding for next year out of New Jersey, you guessed it, the New York football Giants and the rotting corpse of Eli Manning. So, yeah, you're exactly right. There has to be an adjustment there, but that's also part of what you get into when you have DraftKings and FanDuel leading the market and having them be fairly new into the sportsbook game. Right? This, you know, it's not like they're just carrying over. It's not like, you know, you're dealing with MGM being in Atlantic City and then also being in Vegas and having that bookmaking expertise from a guy like a Jay Root that just goes straight across. You know, so there's a little bit of an adjustment period in there that I am a bit surprised there wasn't a little bit more accounting for in the opening line.
We have like 2 minutes here, but this is interesting, and I'm sure you're up on this. It's up on the site again on Twitter. It's at LSP Report. What is the deal with the Wire Act when it comes to New Jersey and Pennsylvania? And why is Sheldon Adelson's name being bounced around?
Oh, God. 2 minutes, huh? So here's what we're going to do with this. We'll give you the short version. Sheldon Adelson, who is the owner of the Venetian, the owner of Palazzo, is well known to have been an opponent over time of internet gambling. And there is a belief, and I am not here to tell you this is true or not, but I'm telling you that this is the perception that's out there, and these letters that are referenced in the article at Legal Sports Report go right toward that. There is a belief that because of Adelson's close relationship with President Trump and the large amount of money that he donated to the Republicans in the last election, that there was some favor with which the Department of Justice looked upon Adelson's position on internet gambling. And a Wire Act opinion that had been issued in 2011 was reversed in the past month. And that Wire Act opinion basically said, to give you the legalese that Justin Watkins would be able to do a better job than me, it basically said that transmissions over wire, which, I mean, this was written in the 60s, so you might have been talking about actual wire and phones. I mean, really, this, to give you, you know, quick background on that, you're talking about a law that was written to try to take care of bookies on rotary phones, and now we're trying to apply it to the internet. But we're talking about now that it used to just apply to sports betting per the 2011 opinion, and now they're saying it could apply to all forms of internet-based gambling.